The suit was black silk, smooth and glossy. The sleeves and legs were puffy like cavalry breeches, but the fabric gathered tight at Horace's wrists and calves with black leather bracers, and around his waist with a matching belt. Gold studs accented the bracers and belt. A long black cape and knee-high boots completed the ensemble. The chief tailor held up a plate-sized mirror.
Titulo hici capruantum bellum?
It's extraordinary, if that's what you're asking.
At the snap of the tailor's fingers, his assistants gathered up their implements and left. Horace stood alone in his apartment. Tonight was the queen's party, which he would soon be attending. He had hoped Alira would be here to attend to him. She had a talent for calming him, something he could really use right now. But she had been called away. Hearing the front door, he hurried to the foyer, hoping it was Alira. But instead, a short, stooped man with a cane limped through the door.
Lord Mulcibar, it's good to see you again.
Good evening, Master Horace. I trust you are well.
What do you think?
Well, I think you have come a long way from being a slave. May we sit a moment?
Horace ushered the nobleman into the parlor, and they reclined on the soft divans.
Can I offer you anything, my lord? A drink?
No, thank you. We don't have much time. The Queen's Guard will be here momentarily to escort you, but I wanted a chance to speak with you first.
Of course. I hoped I'd see you as well. Can you shed some light on what's happening? I feel like a carpenter's apprentice handling his first hammer.
Master Horace, I'm afraid you are in extreme danger.
How so?
Aragash balances on the edge of a precipice. On one side, there is the Queen, may she live forever, and arrayed against her are a variety of forces. The royal court is a pit of vipers, all vying to be Her Majesty's favorite. It's a never-ending game of deception, shifting alliances, and betrayal. Then there is the Temple of the Sun God, never satisfied, no matter how deep its tentacles have sunk into this city's affairs. And you are caught in the middle of it.
I didn't ask to be.
Of course not. You are simply unaware, and it's no wonder. Zoanii, who have played this game all their lives, can fall prey to their competitors at any moment. What should concern you is a plot that I believe is aimed at supplanting the Queen herself.
How does this involve me? I don't know anyone at court except for you and the Queen.
I don't know. I have been chasing down this particular scheme for a long time, but I'm afraid I know little except that they want to use your arrival in Aragosh to their advantage.
What do they want?
As far as I can tell, they want the Queen dispatched.
You mean they want to kill her?
Assassination attempts are not uncommon, and oftentimes those caught in the line of fire are the first to die.
So what should I do?
Conduct yourself as normal. However, if there is an attempt on Her Majesty's life, it will be sudden and lethal. I advise that you defend yourself by any and all means.
I don't know how to control the power. Even if I did, this isn't my concern. No offense, Lord Mulcibar, but I was a captive yesterday and a slave not long before that.
Horace and Mulcibar stood up and walked back into the foyer.
That is all true. I won't try to convince you that the Queen is one of your saints. But we are involved in an internal war, Master Horace. You may not have asked to be set down in the middle of it, but that's where you find yourself. As I see it, you have two choices. You can run, and likely find yourself back in a dungeon cell, if not executed.
What's my other option?
Pick a side, Master Horace, and hold on tight.
The two officers of the Queen's Guard entered. Lord Mulcibar paused on his way out and leaned close to the elder soldier. The soldier nodded. Horace followed them out. They arrived at a chamber that was every bit as large as the audience hall, if not larger. Hundreds of tiny lights illuminated the high walls and the graceful curves of the vaulted ceiling. At first, Horace thought the lights were candles. But then he saw that the lights were wavering tongues of energy without wick or taper, just hovering against the stonework like a cloud of fireflies. Lit by the spectral lights, the entire room had a magical atmosphere. Gold accents glittered on every decoration. The walls were painted with frescoes in bright tones of purple, salmon, and yellow.
Excuse me, Master Horace.
Lord Mulcibar disappeared into the crowd. The hall was filled with people draped in silk and jewelry. The soldiers watched, but otherwise left Horace alone as he made a casual circuit around the chamber.
Master Horace!
The crowd parted. Queen Byleth sauntered toward him in an outfit he couldn't quite believe. The smoky silk gown left her arms and the upper slopes of her breasts bare. But she might as well have been nude, since the material was virtually transparent. Her twin bodyguards stood behind her. They wore black robes again, but tailored in different styles. Jeantou wore a tight, straight robe of rough cloth with a crimson sash as his only accessory. Gilgan's robe was shimmering silk, cut to expose his muscular arms.
There you are. We've been waiting for you.
I hope I'm not late. You look, well, amazing, Your Excellence.
Horace nodded to the twin sorcerers, but they stared through him, not deigning to acknowledge his presence. The queen latched onto his arm.
And you look good enough to devour. Come, there are people I want you to meet.
Horace forced himself to smile as she guided him through the crowd.
What is this party for?
Byleth nodded across the hall to a group of men in white and gold military uniforms with colorful badges on their chests.
You're welcoming the new emissary of Thum. Each city of the Empire sends a representative to Erugash to sit on the governing council for a term of 7 years.
I confess, Excellence, your country's system of government confuses me.
You're not alone. Sometimes I think the bureaucrats create new laws and protocols just to keep the rest of us ignorant of what they're up to. But it's a product of the armistice.
I'm not familiar with that.
About 20 years ago, there was a war between the priestly factions. We called it the God's War. It wasn't a war between armies, although there were occasional skirmishes in the streets. It was more a political battle. The Sun Cult emerged victorious, with some assistance from the Imperial family, and embarked on a campaign to spread its power throughout the Empire as the preeminent priesthood. My father, King Rathamon, did not agree with this. Our family had long supported the faith of the Moon Goddess, who is our city's patroness. So we rose up in rebellion. My father did not seek conquest, but he knew that no city would be safe from the tightening leash of the Sun Cult unless something was done.
But things didn't go so well.
The other 9 cities, coerced by the priests of the Sun Lord, banded together against Erugash. My father died within sight of the walls. I had just turned 11.
A servant woman came forward with a tray of brown squares set on tiny pieces of paper. Horace blinked when he noticed the servant was Alira, wearing a sheer topaz blue tunic that came down to the tops of her thighs, and nothing else. Her face had been made up with rouge and kohl, but Horace could see the hints of blush reddening her cheeks. Her eyes were downcast. Byleth took 2 pieces from the tray and offered one to Horace.
Try this, you'll love it.
He considered the brown substance as he watched Alira out of the corner of his eye.
I hope you don't mind that I borrowed my favorite handmaiden back. But there's no one else I would trust to attend me at an event like this. This one has such skillful hands, as perhaps you are already aware.
Of course not.
The food was actually quite good. It was soft and melted into sweet goo on his tongue. The queen led him away. Each time he turned his head as they walked, Horace couldn't keep from glancing back at Alira, following behind them.
So why am I...
Shari Azratu!
Horace turned to face a huge man. He was half a head shorter than Horace and corpulent in the extreme. His pristine white uniform looked large enough to shelter an entire family. Horace watched Alira. She was looking around as if studying the faces in the crowd.
This is Master Horace Del Rosa, a traveler from the land of Arnos.
Horace bowed his head, but as he looked up, he saw a frown crease the envoy's plump lips.
Simtumno libriuti saratum.
The queen started to lead Horace away.
Tamuris!
Byleth nodded and smiled, but kept walking away. Horace caught the envoy's dark look in their direction before the crowd obscured him.
That didn't sound very friendly.
Lord Bafator never passes an opportunity to remind me of my fallen stature. He can barely light a candle with his Zoana, but his family is wealthy and has powerful alliances, so I must pretend to enjoy his company.
What is Tamuris?
The queen guided Horace to a corner of the hall and stopped before a large fresco. It showed a slender woman rising from the earth. She was quite beautiful and garbed only in a white cloth about her loins.
This is Tammuz. She is the goddess of seasons and of the cycle of life and death that all things experience. Here she is shown by herself, but oftentimes she is shown as four women. The child, the mother, and the crone.
That's only three.
The fourth is death.
And the Tamuris has something to do with this goddess?
It is the name of the High Holy Day when we celebrate the celestial marriage between Tammuz and the Lord of the Underworld.
What did that Lord, Bafator, bring it up?
You are a rare man, Horace of Tynes. There are few even in my inner court who would question me as you do. Are all your countrymen so familiar in the presence of royalty?
If I offended your excellence, I apologize.
There, now you sound like every other courtier. Tell me, what do you think of these murals? I find them quite amusing.
Amusing?
Yes. When my father started construction on this palace, he couldn't find any artists willing to adorn the interior. The priesthoods, you see, had secured every painter in the city with long-term commissions in protest because they believed it was unholy for a king to build a palace taller than their temples. My father was forced to hire artists from elsewhere at great expense. It amuses me how the priests perceive everything in life as revolving around them. Even kings and queens must come to bow before their altars.
It's not much different in Arnos. The king rules, but the true church guides him and everyone else as well. We are taught that service to the Almighty is the highest good a man can do.
Our priesthoods think much the same way. But my father taught me something quite different before he died.
What do you serve, Excellence?
Horace realized his mistake with one look at her face. The alluring demeanor had been replaced with a stern visage.
Pardon me. I'm not thinking straight tonight.
I will forgive you, Master Horace, if you tell me more about your country. Courtship customs, for instance. What does an Arnossi woman do when she admires a man?
Well, it's been quite some time since I dabbled in such things, Your Excellence. But I believe the custom is for the man to approach her parents with his intentions.
And the woman has no say in the matter?
Well, perhaps not in the eyes of society, but I seem to recall that most of the women I knew had a great deal of say in the matter.
I see.
A group of nobles waved to Byleth, and she stepped over to meet them, all smiles. Horace looked back at Alira. He wanted to ask if she was all right, but she hurried after the queen before he could say anything. Gilgan smiled, but then his brother elbowed him, and they strode after the queen. Horace caught up as Byleth left the nobles.
I'm sorry about comparing you to my other courtiers. You are nothing like them.
You don't need to apologize, Excellence.
I know. That's what makes it so stimulating.
Horace saw Alira over the queen's shoulder, studiously looking away as if she wasn't paying them any mind.
I'll be leaving the hall soon, and I want to see you afterward in my chambers.
Three priests in cloth of gold robes waited a few steps away, their bald heads shining in the mystical light. The priest at the head of the small procession was old, his scalp covered in faded tattoos.
Sobe etu saratum.
I greet you, Holy Father of the Sun. Horace, this is High Priest Kadumun of the Temple of Amur.
I am honored to meet your, Eminence.
Shomana Ulukur, Alakti.
He is curious about your impressions of our realm.
You make excellent wine.
Byleth's smile became a trifle strained as she passed his answer along to the holy men.
Sobe katafin.
The High Priest smirked.
Den kurlus ihina, minat simho tombafin.
He says you have a cultured palate. And perhaps one day you will allow him the honor of showing you the temple's wine cellars.
I would enjoy that.
The delegation shuffled away through the crowd at the old priest's pace.
The high priest seems like a nice chap.
Yes, I especially enjoyed the way he threatened to imprison you.
He did what?
That bit about inviting you to his wine cellars. That's what people call the dungeons beneath the temple where they keep the heretics awaiting execution.
In that case, I take back what I said.
Now you're learning, Master Horace. The court is a jungle filled with carnivores. The strong prey upon the weak, and the weak plot to overthrow the strong.
I'll try to remember that.
I hope so. I'd like to see you survive a little longer. Oh, Peshka.
A man in an extravagant outfit of emerald green silk strode toward them. Horace remembered him from his first audience with the queen. The man had been sitting beside her throne. His short black hair was oiled and coiffed to perfection, yet his handsome features were marred by an angry scowl. Horace thought about the familiar way in which he and Byleth had been circling the hall together this evening.
This must be her betrothed, and he thinks that she and I are...
What were we discussing?
The queen did nothing, but the twins strode forward to intercept the man. They did not touch him, but each held up an open hand, and the royal fiancé halted. Yet that didn't stop him from arguing quietly and gesticulating wildly.
He seems quite upset.
Ignore him. It's nothing.
In that case, I was wondering if there was any chance Your Excellency would consider...
The queen's face blanched as she stopped mid-step. Before Horace could ask what was wrong, a dagger-sharp pain tore through his head. The entire chamber was in disarray, with many nobles clutching their heads. Then the pain was gone as swiftly as it had come.
What was that?
The queen snapped her fingers and her bodyguard straightened up. With narrowed eyes, the twins cleared a path through the hall. Byleth grabbed Horace's arm and dragged him after them. Alira followed close behind. Then Lord Mulcibar was there. The queen stopped as he spoke quietly in her ear. Suddenly, the ground bucked under Horace. He grabbed hold of Alira and they clung together as the palace quaked. Priests and nobles crashed into one another. The queen staggered toward Horace, but the twins both reached out and kept her upright. The tremor only lasted a couple of heartbeats, but it felt like minutes. When it was over, Horace remained still. A flash of light shot through the tall chamber windows. Green lightning. A strong wind, laden with ozone, blew in through the open portals. The queen extricated herself from her bodyguards. She glanced once at Horace and Alira, raised an eyebrow, and gestured at people around her. The soldiers, who were converging on her position, turned and ran for the door. The twins retook their position behind the queen as she followed the soldiers. Horace's legs were still a little shaky, but he released his grip on Alira.
Are you all right?
Alira headed toward the windows. Horace was about to join her when Lord Mulcibar emerged from the crowd, hobbling on his cane.
Is everything all right?
We must go, now.
Where?
Follow the queen. I fear she will need every ally she can find.
The nobleman gave Horace a penetrating glance and then started in the direction the queen had taken. Most of the other nobles were leaving as well, pressing through the other doors and archways. Horace started after Mulcibar when Alira grabbed his arm.
Come with me.
What? The queen is...
I'm getting you out of here.
Alira steered Horace toward a side door.
Now? I don't think it's a good time to be outside with the storm.
Listen, I have friends in the city. They'll help you escape if we can get outside the palace. What is it?
Horace was looking up at the ceiling. He could feel the power of the storm overhead, churning with a dark hunger as it lashed out.
I have to go.
That's right. We can get you out a postern on the south side.
No. I have to go help the queen.
No, Horace, this is your chance to get away.
I'm sorry.
Horace extricated himself from Alira's grasp.
Find a safe place until the storm passes.
But what about...
Horace turned away and hurried after Lord Mulcibar. He caught up with the nobleman in the grand hallway as another tremor shook the palace. Horace's legs almost collapsed as the pain returned, constricting his chest. He leaned against the archway for support, feeling like he was going to pass out. Then Alira was there. With an exasperated glare, she propped her shoulder under his arm.
The stairs!
What?
Lord Mulcibar was hunched against the other wall, bracing himself upright with his cane. Horace stumbled over to the nobleman. Together, he and Alira half-walked, half-dragged Mulcivar down the corridor. After a few dozen steps, the nobleman regained enough strength to walk under his own power. He took them up through the central stairways of the palace, making Horus uncomfortable.
Do these storms occur here often?
No.
There.
Lord Mulcivar climbed onto a landing and pointed his cane at a sturdy teakwood door. Horus opened it. The wind whipped Horus's clothes. Through the door was a short corridor where the queen and her retinue stood by another doorway, which was open to the outside. Bright green light illuminated the corridor, and thunder shook the walls. Fresh agony ripped through his chest. It was several seconds before it passed. By that time, Lord Mulcivar had joined the queen's gathering. Horus pulled Alira aside.
Listen, I don't think you should be here. If these people are set on confronting the Almighty, I don't know if I can...
Horus!
The queen stood by the outer door, reaching out a hand toward him. With a grimace, he left Alira's side. The people gathered in the passageway were, he noticed, all nobles.
All sorcerers too, I'll wager.
A few of the aristocrats frowned as Horus entered their circle, but they made room for him. The queen led them in some series of mystical gestures and silent prayers, but Lord Mulcivar moved beside Horus.
Are you all right?
I'm scared out of my wits. How about you?
We shall find out very soon.
Horus glanced out the open door. A portico extended into the night. Driving rain beat the gray pavestones. The queen took a step toward the doorway. A bolt of jagged green lightning crossed the sky, outlining her form in an emerald nimbus.
It's time.
Horus watched the nobles march out through the door behind the queen. He couldn't let them face it alone, because the truth was that he had come to admire these people. Some of them, at least. He looked over his shoulder. Alira stood in the shadow of the hallway. He nodded to her and then walked out. As he stepped over the threshold, his stomach turned upside down. The nobles stood in the center of a broad terrace, huddled close together in their soaked apparel. The sky was a sheet of black iron, spitting blood-warm rain and bolts of eerie lightning. He looked up.
Holy Father in heaven.
The storm raged over the city, larger and more fearsome than any tempest he'd ever seen. Despite his misgivings, Horus was drawn to the play of light and shadow across the stormy heavens. Watching the sporadic barrage of levin bolts, he sensed a pattern in their movements, like a puzzle he might unlock if he stared long enough. He took a step toward the marble balustrade bordering the terrace.
Horus!
Tearing his gaze away from the sky, Horus saw Lord Mulcivar beckoning to him. The ache in his chest was fierce, but he hurried over to the nobles. He said nothing as he joined their circle, unsure of what he was supposed to do. Lord Mulcivar turned to him.
We are going to try to deflect the storm in a southerly direction, away from the city.
What do I do?
The ritual is in Akkesian, but you don't need to know the words. The queen will lead us. Just focus on your car.
My what?
The seat of your energy. Feel it moving and try to lend it to the group. Don't worry. Once you feel your Zoana rise, the ritual will take over.
Armed men ran through the streets. Thick, acrid smoke filled the air. Shahram put his back against the wall of the potter's shop. At least Emanon delivered his message. Blood ran thick in Aragosh this night. The point of Jaram's spear was stained red. It had been a long time since he'd been in battle. He didn't mourn the soldiers he'd slain today, but some part of him wondered if this was all worth it. It had been a good raid. He estimated his band had killed 70 or 80 soldiers. If the other team was as successful, then the rebellion had struck a stinging blow. Jaram glanced around the corner onto the main avenue that sliced through the city center. He had entered Aragosh with 36 rebel dog soldiers through a little used gate on the north side, courtesy of Emanon's contacts. Once inside, they made their way to the government ward at the city center and divided forces. Emanon took half the rebels east to hit the granaries, while Jaram and the other half attacked the militia barracks. However, the assault on the barracks had almost ended in disaster. An alarm sounded while Jaram's squad dealt with the off-duty soldiers, and reinforcements arrived before they could disengage. Jaram had ordered his fighters to scatter and meet back at the rendezvous point, but somewhere in the chaos he found himself wandering through the city's back alleys, alone.
All the nights for a storm to hit, it had to be this one.
Jaram sprinted down an alleyway. He thought he saw some of the others at the mouth of a side street, quickened his pace, and caught up with a group of rebel fighters. Their leader, Shirkil, was one of Emanon's lieutenants. Silfar and Partha were from the east. Silphar didn't talk much, and Partha never shut up. Other than that, they were inseparable, and Jaram wondered privately if they were more than just comrades. Chakur was the youngest of the group. Tall and well-built, he was an orphan. His shopkeeper parents had been caught in a fight between rival street gangs and killed. The rebels stood over a trio of corpses in the yellow uniforms of priestly soldiers.
Has anyone seen Eminem?
Not since we split up to hit the granaries. He might have been cut off and had to change his route.
Chakur turned to Jaram.
Are we attacking the palace next?
Partha shook his head angrily.
Fuck that.
Stay with me. We're headed to the backup meeting place.
But Eminem said that we were...
He's right. We'll be picked up if we stay here.
Jaram gestured toward what he thought was the right direction. The rebels headed off, with Jerkiel leading the way and Chakur looking back over his shoulder. Jaram fell in behind them. As the rebels approached a small plaza on the edge of a hard-bitten neighborhood called the Dredge, a figure ran out of an adjacent alleyway.
Jaram!
Where have you been?
Just having a bit of fun with Her Majesty's toy soldiers.
Jaram saw the clump of rebel fighters behind Eminem. A weight lifted off his chest when he saw some familiar faces.
Is this all we have left?
No. I sent a party back to hold the gate.
We'll need every sword to get inside the palace.
Eminon looked to the others, signaling Jerkiel to stay alert, and then pulled Jaram to a deep doorway on the other side of the plaza. It was nice to get out of the rain, even if only for a few moments.
Listen, Jaram. I know what I said, but we can't risk it tonight. We need to leave the city now, before this storm gets worse.
The rain isn't going to stop me. We could be in and out before anyone discovers us.
I went to check out the palace after the last granary went up. There's no chance of getting inside tonight. Not if we had twice as many men. I told you, Jaram, I'm not going to risk lives on a suicide mission. We'll try it another time.
So that's it? We just abandon him?
We wouldn't be doing your friend any favors getting ourselves killed. There'll be other opportunities.
But we're already here in the city. Damn you, Eminem. You knew this was important to me.
And you swore to follow my orders. So what's it going to be?
Fine.
We'll get him. Just trust me. Okay.
So you want to tell me what we accomplished on this mission? And don't give me any nonsense about a training exercise. You risked the lives of these men. Why?
I was spreading evidence.
Of what?
The Empire is under attack by crusaders from Etonia. My informants tell me that the Queen is concerned about the recent advances into her territory, but so far she's held back her legions. So I left some Western-style weapons and scraps of foreign uniforms with the bodies of her dead soldiers.
You want Aragash to launch an attack on these invaders? Let them destroy each other, and then we remain to pick up the pieces. Is that your master plan?
Part of it.
So if you're making this up as you go along, what's our next move?
That depends on what our lords and masters do. After tonight, things are going to get rough for all of us. Hoping the Queen will call up her reserves and send a message to the Crusaders.
You're risking a lot on that decision. With only a handful of fighters, we don't have any room for mistakes.
I've been fighting in this land for most of my life. First as a soldier in the Imperial Legions, now as a slave. But it's all the same. Blood and meat, life and death. Those of us who survive are just as dead as those we put in the ground. Most just don't know it yet. But what we're doing, resisting the Empire, is a worthy thing, I think. Maybe worth dying for.
So now we go to war?
Aye. To war.
Byleth mouthed Akeshian phrases, their sound lost to human ears amid the chaos. Her face was lifted to the ebony sky. The nobles did the same, and Horus watched as a burst of yellow-orange flame materialized. Streams of fire, flowing like liquid, rose from some of the Zoanii in the circle, flying up into the sky inside a funnel of spinning air. Wounds appeared on the Zoanii, deep gashes across their faces and bodies that widened with every passing heartbeat. Two nobles fell to the wet tiles and did not move. Their blood mixed with the rain to run in pink streams down their expensive clothing. Byleth looked up to the sky as if searching for answers. Horus felt useless, doubly so because he could sense the others watching him, waiting, he knew, for some miracle. But nothing happened. Another noble collapsed, her eyes closed in agony as she curled up at their feet. Then the Queen staggered. The twin sorcerers grabbed her by the arms before she could fall. A long cut ran down the side of her neck. Horus started to cross the circle to her when a bolt of green lightning lanced out of the sky to strike the top of the palace. A shock ran through Horus from head to heels. All his muscles went rigid as a wave of energy poured into him, filling him up. He opened his mouth to shout. A torrent of energy burst out of him. His eyes were squeezed shut tight, but in his mind, he imagined a jet of white-hot fire shooting into the sky. He returned to his senses on the terrace floor, the paved stones pressing against the wet material of his jacket. The rain splattered into his eyes. He blinked it away. The queen and her nobles were also on the ground, several of them thrashing limply while a few remained still. Byleth was trying to lift her head. Blood trickled from her left nostril. That's when Horus noticed that the wind was gone. The sky, when he looked up, was still dark, but the violent thunderclouds had vanished to reveal a web of constellations. Horus crawled to the queen on his hands and knees, not trusting his legs to hold him up. Her eyes were opened wide and unblinking. A stream of blood ran down her chest from the cut on her throat.
Your Excellence.
I think I'm all right. What happened?
I was about to ask you the same thing.
Byleth reached out to touch Horus's face.
Not even a mark?
Soldiers rushed over. Xantu and Gilgen were there as well, both of them bleeding around the eyes. Xantu pressed his hand to the queen's neck wound while his brother stood watch over them. A moment later, Xantu removed his hand, and the queen's injury was closed with only a long scab remaining. The twin sorcerers helped her get to her feet. Horus straightened up slowly. Then Alira was there, holding him up again. He was too weak to resist as she steered him back toward the door.
I can't believe what just happened.
I'm afraid I missed most of it. You'll have to give me the details later.
As they filed back inside, several Zoanii leaned against the walls of the corridor. Their eyes followed him and Alira with flinty expressions.
Belisama!
Alira halted, pulling Horus to a sudden stop.
What?
Other nobles looked back and forth at each other and at him.
Stormlord, that's what they're calling you.
Is that good?
I don't know.
A soldier in the queen's livery rushed into the passage. He dropped to his knees before Byleth and began talking in quick bursts.
Something's wrong.
There's been an attack on the royal barracks. Many were killed.
An attack?
Shh. The granaries have also been set on fire.
The queen swung her hand, and the messenger flew against the wall hard enough to break bones. Everyone else scrambled out of her way as she strode past. She was followed by Lord Mulcibar and those nobles who had recovered enough to walk. The twins brought up the rear of the rain-soaked procession, both scowling as they bent their heads together in private conversation. Horus looked back out the doorway to the fiery glow along the skyline.
Are you ready to go? It looks like you could use a bath and a long sleep.
That sounds wonderful. I could sleep for a month.
He tried not to look at the dead messenger lying against the wall as he walked past. Leaving her soldiers outside, Byleth led Xantu and Gilgen down the long, winding tunnel into the earth. The walls were rounded and almost smooth with a faint reflective sheen. Despite the glowing red runes inscribed on the tunnel ceiling every 20 paces to stifle the intense heat that flowed up from the depths of the earth, the walls and floor were still hot enough to burn bare skin. She held onto a trickle of Zoanna to maintain a halo of coolness around herself, and not a hint of perspiration dampened the sheer silk of her dress. Three men bowed as she passed them at an intersection of two tunnels. Lord Astapta's minions were uniformly thin to the point of emaciation, and they all wore the same ash-gray robe that matched their complexions. They never spoke within her hearing, and it occurred to Byleth that she didn't know much about what went on down here. When Lord Astapta had first come to her with his ideas, she needed a place to keep him close but out of sight. These lava tubes under the palace had seemed like the perfect solution. Byleth entered the main chamber, and nearly choked at the powerful stench of brimstone that billowed around her. Air currents rising from the moat of red-hot magma below played with her hair. Seven figures stared down from the shadows obscuring the chamber's ceiling. 7 massive statues carved from the basalt walls. Byleth recalled being nervous when Astapte built this hidden shrine to the 7 demon lords of the underworld. She had stood in this chamber right after its construction, with Lord Astapte standing before her, holding a red candle and a copper dagger, lifting the implements to the statues as he chanted in his native tongue. Looking back now, Byleth wondered why she had participated in the ritual. Astapte had said it was necessary to seal their pact. She also remembered being desperate for a means to escape her fate. Comforted by the presence of Xantu and Gilgun behind her, she descended the metal catwalks. The tall chamber didn't have a floor. Instead, a pool of magma bubbled and churned around an island of rock rising from its center. Lord Astapte stood on the island, working on the machine occupying most of its area. A glittering stone hovered over his shoulder. Looking like a sliver of onyx, it radiated a fierce blue light. Byleth and the twins stepped across the narrow stone bridge.
You had better have a good explanation.
I am busy. If this can wait until I have...
This will not wait. Do you realize that I was almost killed tonight?
Astapte drew himself up to his full height, looming over her. Her bodyguards came up to flank her. The floating onyx stone hung in the air between them, rotating slowly.
I have been preoccupied.
Byleth gestured to the metal construction above them. The storm engine was displeasing to the eye, old girders and connecting struts, lacking the graceful lines that she demanded from all things in her presence. Thick cables ran from the apparatus to the chamber walls, disappearing into the stone. She remembered the day when Lord Astapte, not long after his near-fatal journey across the southern desert, had come to her with a proposal that she give him the means to build this metal monstrosity. Through it, he had promised, she would become the most powerful ruler in Akeshia. For the daughter of a king who had failed in his own bid to win the Chalcedony throne, the chance to do what her father had not was irresistible.
You told me your contraption would protect Erugash from these storms.
It did better than that. The engine achieved terminal charge 58 minutes before true midnight.
Are you saying that you created the storm?
Not precisely. A storm front was moving through the area when the engine became active. The atmospheric activity presumably aided in the...
Don't babble. Just tell me. Did your machine create that storm or not?
In a sense, yes.
What went wrong?
When the surge struck, the etheric distributor went into a systemic feedback loop that affected the...
Spare me any more details. You say you can fix it?
Of course, though it will take time. Time better spent than talking with you here about...
Watch your tongue.
Xantu glowered at the vizier. Then Gilgun also turned to him with a mocking smile.
Or you might lose it.
Byleth almost reached for her Zoanna. As it was, she felt the twins seething with the desire for violent release. She stilled them with a wave of her hand.
I also told you that this is not a precise science. However, I too am puzzled. The engine should have been insulated from any harm. It's almost as if something...
As if what?
It's as if a stronger force had overridden the power of the storm. But it is difficult to countenance. Would have had to be more power than a dozen Zoanii of the first rank bound together in a single stroke.
I may have your explanation. When the storm struck, I took all the Zoanii I could lay hands upon and tried to deflect the storm away from the city. I had no idea what you were doing down here. If I'd known, I would have...
And you were successful?
Actually, yes. Against all odds, we dispelled the storm entirely. It was quite amazing. I don't know if another cabal in recent times could have done it.
A bold maneuver.
He saved us.
Majesty?
The savage.
The foreigner? What did he do?
I'm not entirely sure. His Zoanna is exceptionally strong, but he has no control over it. It leaps and jumps about like the typhoon in flood season, overflowing its channel and washing away everything in its path.
Interesting.
What are you going to do about it?
The foreigner is your concern.
Forget him. You promised to deliver the Empire to me.
And so I shall.
When?
In due time. This is no simple task. We will have only one chance for success. It needs to be timed with perfection.
My enemies are moving against me. I can feel them breathing on the back of my neck, and Sayasa seems farther away now than on the day I saved you.
I am not the weakling you found on your doorstep. I serve you of my own free will and for my own purposes.
But you do serve me, Astapta. Never forget that.
I would never dream of it.
I want it ready in 3 days, Astapta, or I'll come back and take your head as recompense. Do you understand?
I do.
Good. Now I wish to see him.
As you wish.
Followed by the floating stone, Astapta led Byleth back across the bridge and through a wide tunnel. It sloped downward, taking them deeper underground as it twisted in a slow curve. Byleth was glad she'd decided to bring the twins. She had never feared for her own safety before. Her training and strength in the Umavar Dominion was unequaled in the city. But there was something about these catacombs that unnerved her. Byleth gestured for the twins to remain outside, as Astapta ushered her into a chamber carved from the living stone. The only furnishing was an upright slab of gray stone positioned against the far wall under an array of wires and cables that extended up to the ceiling, leading, she knew, to the storm engine. By the stark light of the onyx stone, Byleth observed the man on the slab. His muscular body and limbs were bound in wide bands of Zoahadin. His eyes were bruised purple and black around his closed lids. Dried blood stuck to a circular cut on his forehead. It was funny. She'd known him all her life, and yet she had never understood him as well as she did now. For years, Astapta had been demanding proper subjects for his work. Byleth had heard his accounts of trying to use livestock, but people produced the best results. Criminals, dissidents, and the undesirables of society had all been assigned to her chief vizier's less than tender mercies. But it wasn't until he chanced upon a victim, a young leper girl, if she recalled correctly, with latent magical talent that his experiments took a turn for the better.
Zazil? Can you hear me?
Her brother opened his eyes. He tried to speak, but his lips had been sewn together. His arms and legs twitched within their Zoahadin binders, but that was the limit of his movement.
So how does this work?
It is, in essence, a Zoana pump. It will slowly drain your brother of his Zoana.
Byleth studied Zazil's face. This was her flesh, her blood. She could read the question in his gaze. She leaned down so she could look into his eyes.
Of course I must let you die this way, brother. There is a price for betrayal.
Zazil shook his head violently, and Byleth placed a finger over his sewn lips to still him.
Don't bother denying it. I know all about your dealings with the Temple of Amur. You've been jealous of my birthright since we were children. I hoped you had outgrown it, but it seems you have given me no choice.
Astapta hunched over a panel of metal levers against the wall. Each lever was marked with an unfamiliar icon, possibly derived from his native alphabet. He took a long metallic hose from a hook on the wall. Its open end was surrounded by sharp prongs like teeth, which he placed upon Zazil's forehead. Her brother arched up from the slab like a puppet pulled by its strings.
How long will he last?
The prince is young and strong. It may take days to drain him completely.
Yes, he was always strong. How did you manage to take him alive? Poison? Treachery?
I enjoyed a stroke of good fortune, Majesty. And proper timing.
I have delivered my end of the bargain, my lord. You have your perfect specimen. Now you have 3 days to deliver on your promise.
Once I have calibrated the engine to accept the new levels of power, I believe we shall be ready.
And I'll be able to direct the storms however I wish, at any time?
Yes, however and whenever. Their powers will be yours to command.
Don't disappoint me, Astapta. My patience is coming to an end.
The door of the chamber opened, and one of the vizier's robed minions entered. The wizened man stole over to Astapta's side and whispered something Byleth couldn't hear. After a few seconds, the servant departed.
What is it?
Omicor has fallen to the Crusaders.
Byleth fought the urge to smash something. Omicor was a major trading hub and one of the most important towns in the Western Desert. Zaziel had burst his lip sutures.
I need your engine to work. Now!
As you wish, the risk will be yours.
Ni.
Ni.
Fa.
Fe.
No, fa.
Fa.
Ti.
Can we take a break?
Alira set down the papyrus upon which were drawn the letters of the Akkeshian alphabet. It was 2 days after the storm. For the last 3 hours, she had been trying to teach Horus how to read. She held up a stylus.
What is this called?
Kamei.
Good. And that?
I could really use
it. What is it called?
Nuru.
Nuru is light. Lamp is Imaru.
Enough. I can't learn the entire damn language in a day.
You won't learn it at all if you're going to act like a spoiled child.
Alira picked up another scroll from the table in the center of the sitting room and unrolled the heavy papyrus.
Let's return to translating. You were doing well.
Later. I've had enough stories about pagan gods and talking animals. Between you and Lord Mulsabar, all I've been doing is studying.
Well, you have a lot to learn.
You think I don't know that? I'm sorry.
So why don't you tell me what's really bothering you?
It's too much to absorb all at once. And I haven't been sleeping very well since...
The storm?
Yes. Everything is so mixed up. Why am I here? What does it all mean?
What if it means nothing?
I think that scares me the most. I'd like to know what the Queen wants with me.
You're valuable, Horus. The Queen recognizes that, so she keeps you near.
Valuable? I'm a foreigner. I don't speak the language very well, and I'm not even worth ransoming.
You're a sorcerer of power. In every city of Akkeshia, the ruling houses bind the Zuanii to them. By marriage, by title, even with blackmail. Because whoever controls the most power, Zuana, controls the empire. The Queen will seek to use you, or barring that, to make sure that no one else can use you against her.
Horus picked up the papyrus and tried to commit the symbols to memory.
Anyway, Lord Mulsabar is coming by today.
He's coming here?
That's what he said.
Alira all but ran to her small room. She came back out and hurried past, a short cloak wrapped about her shoulders.
I must attend the Queen. I forgot until now. I'll return this evening and we'll work on your penmanship. Horus, be careful around Lord Mulsabar.
Why do you say that? He's been decent to me since I got here, more decent than anyone else, except for you.
I know, but he's a member of the Queen's court and...
Alira answered the door, bowing from the waist as Lord Mulsabar entered.
Please be welcome, my lord.
I trust I am not too early.
Not at all. Come in.
Alira dipped out the door and closed it behind her.
Can I take your cloak?
No, no. At my age, you live in perpetual fear of a sudden chill.
Very well. Where shall we, is there any special place where we should go for...
How about the courtyard? It's a lovely day.
All right.
In addition to a grand view of the city, Horace's apartment had access to a private terrace with a garden. On the way out, Mulsabar stopped beside the table and picked up the sheet of papyrus.
I'm trying to learn, but Akkeshian isn't the easiest language to pick up, and the writing is just a mess of scribbles to me.
In a way, you are correct.
Lord Mulsabar pointed to the first letter.
Ska. It is derived from the phrase Skavin Sinteluras Aidodni.
And I thought Ska was hard enough to memorize.
It means the dawn of the first day of the world. And it was originally written like this.
Mulsabar picked up the stylus, dipped it into the inkwell, and drew an elaborate set of lines and curves. Horus craned his neck.
I see. It looks like the sun coming up over the horizon. And there's a bird flying above it.
The bird is Heidodni, the first creature made by Endu, the lord of the sky. But you can see how this pictogram eventually became the first letter, Ska.
I guess so. It seems a lot more complicated than Arnasi.
Keep working at it.
A winding set of steps led them to the walled terrace outside. Tall shrubs lined the walls amid flower beds with blossoms in many colors, lending the space a park-like atmosphere. Lord Mulcibar gazed up at the clear sky. He seemed to be looking for something, but Horace couldn't see anything except the sun riding past its zenith, its rays beating down on them.
You have heard about the attack in the city?
Yes. Some soldiers were killed, and there's a rumor that foreigners were involved.
Yes, that seems to be the case.
I don't know what to say. I'm actually surprised that I haven't been clapped in irons again as a suspect.
If I didn't know exactly where you were at the time and in the hours leading up to the attack, you might be. But Her Majesty knows you had no part in it.
That's good.
Yes. Now, shall we begin?
Mulcibar walked to the far side of the court, a distance of about 20 paces, and turned around. Horace stood facing him.
What do you want me to
Please do not talk. Just listen.
Horace waited for a minute, thinking the nobleman would explain further, but Mulcibar merely watched him.
What am I supposed to be listening to?
To the wind blowing. To the stirring of the branches and the flower petals. To your own heartbeat. When you listen to these things in stillness, you are listening through your car.
I don't understand.
Don't talk. Listen.
Horace swallowed his questions. He could suffer a little peace and quiet, especially if it meant Mulcibar was going to teach him how to use this force inside him. Yet as the minutes passed by, his mind began to wander.
Where did Alira go in such a hurry? I don't believe for a minute her excuse about serving the Queen. There's something suspicious going on. Perhaps she has a lover. I have no rights to her. She belongs to the Queen. And yet, I feel we've shared some intimate moments these past couple of days. She's beautiful. Perfect. In Arno, she could be the wife of a rich man with a family and a fine estate. But here, she's just a slave.
Horace felt his temperature rising as thoughts of Alira's condition made him angry. If he wasn't careful, he would start sweating through his silk robe. A breeze tickled the nape of his neck.
There. Do you feel it? Moving inside you like a river of heat.
No, I don't feel anything except...
Then Horace realized he was feeling something. The now familiar stirring in his chest, warm but also cold. It had come with the anger, so he hadn't recognized it. But now that he was paying attention, he could differentiate between the two sensations. The anger was raw and red in his mind's eye. The other feeling was smoother and deeper. He followed it like a cord inside his chest, down into his stomach, where it blossomed into a host of strange perceptions. He tried to understand what he felt, but it was impossible to put into words. It was like a second heartbeat, but somehow deeper inside him.
You feel it.
Mulcibar's eyes were closed, his arms loose by his sides. For once, he didn't stoop over or lean on his cane. He looked stronger than before, and younger, too.
I don't know. When it happened before, it was like a fountain of white-hot steel exploding out of me. But now I see...
Yes?
Well, a kind of hot and cold sensation, like a second heartbeat.
My teacher called it the gate of heaven. It is your car, the source of your power. Through it, you will access the Zoana. We spent years discovering how to tap into this power and bend it to our will.
I don't know. When I did whatever I did to the storm, I didn't call on any special source. It just happened.
You did it without realizing it. That is very rare and also quite dangerous. That's why the Queen asked me to instruct you. If you cannot control the Zoana, it could be unleashed at any time, but especially when you are feeling angry or afraid.
All right. So how do we proceed?
Be still and listen.
Horace did as the nobleman instructed.
Breathe naturally and try to focus on the gateway inside you. There are 4 dominions of the Zoana corresponding to the elements of nature. Kishagal for the earth. It represents solidity and physical strength. Giru is the dominion of flame, for energy and aggression. Imuvar is the wind, seat of understanding and emotional awareness. And the last is Mordab.
Mulcibar lifted a hand and a ball of clear liquid appeared in the air before him.
Water is the element of fluidity and flexibility. It is my primary dominion. I also have some skill with Imuvar.
Horace frowned at the watery ball passing back and forth between Mulcibar's hands.
Unless you're thirsty, it doesn't sound very intimidating.
Horace didn't have time to duck as the ball flew toward his face, turning white as it crystallized into a globe of ice. A feeling welled up inside him like all the nerves in his body came alive at once. For a moment, he saw a burst of light. Then a shower of cool mist rained over him. Horace had closed his eyes during the explosion of sensations. When he opened them, Lord Mulcivar stood a couple of feet farther away from him. The nobleman's gaze was focused to the side, at the garden. Horace swore as he spotted the smoking bush, its branches blackened, the leaves gone. Behind the ruined flora was a fist-sized gouge in the garden wall.
I only meant to test your reflexes. I've never seen anything approximating your response.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to be the cause.
No, it is I who must apologize, Horace. I've never had a student who could apply the Zoana so naturally. It usually takes months to learn the proper techniques for summoning and harnessing the power.
So what dominion was that?
I'm not sure. But don't worry. With time and experimentation, it will reveal itself to you.
But where does the magic come from?
Lord Mulcivar walked over to one of the garden benches and sat down with his cane between his knees.
To answer that, I will have to ask your forbearance while I tell you a story. A very long time ago, when the first men came to this land, they fished in the waters of the Typhon and learned to grow wheat on its silted plains. It was during that era, according to our oldest records, that the Wanderers came down from the heavens.
The Wanderers? Like angels?
They were called the Children of the Stars, the sons and daughters of the elder gods, come to teach mankind the gifts of civilization, including the use of Zoana. Under their supervision, the great cities were built, and an age of peace and knowledge was born.
So what happened to these gods?
They returned to the immortal world, yet they left behind their gifts. The first magicians were priests, as well as Zoanii, but over time they separated from the people and set themselves up as the rulers.
Hard to argue with someone who could incinerate you with a thought.
Precisely. But it's important to remember that the Zoana did not cause the problem. Many Zoanii feel the power is merely a tool, but it is a manifestation of the worlds above and below.
But I've never had these powers before.
I think they must have been there all the time since you were born, but they had no outlet. Not until something triggered them to come to the surface.
The storm in the desert.
Just so. The energy of the chaos storm called to your Zoana and brought it forth.
What are the storms? You call them chaos, but what does that mean?
The old nobleman tapped the end of his cane on the dusty paved stones.
That is more difficult to answer. All things in the cosmos came from chaos. It is the force of creation as well as destruction.
Horace looked down at the scars across his palms.
Each time I've seen one of these chaos storms, I get a peculiar feeling. It's raw and powerful, almost angry. It makes me want to break something, or worse.
Some of our seers claim that the storms are the embodiment of the gods' wrath, sent down as punishment for our failure to follow their divine ways. Others believe they are a trial to cleanse the Empire of weakness and to fortify us for some great destiny.
You don't sound like you believe either of those theories.
My beliefs are a discussion for another day. I don't know why you feel such things, Horace, but I've been thinking about your lack of Immaculata. Perhaps if I could perform some tests...
I don't like the sound of that.
Forgive me. I was a student of mathematics and science when I was a young man, and some traces of that investigative mindset still reside with me. Yet I cannot help but suspect that the two, your tremendous power and the fact that you do not bleed while invoking it, are somehow related. Every Zoanii sheds the sacred blood while embracing the Zoana, even Her Majesty.
But what causes it?
The priesthoods teach that the Immaculata are the price levied by the gods for the gift of Zoana. Blood feeds the power, and the power nourishes the universe.
Do you think that's why I don't get the wounds? Because I don't follow your ways?
It does not seem reasonable to me, but I am no theologian.
What does the scientist in you say?
That some tests are in order.
Horace felt the weight he'd been carrying around inside his chest ease. Mulcibar leaned on his cane and stood.
But for now, I would like to try something that may give you better control over your power.
Yes, sir. That would be most welcome.
Oh, very good. Now relax and stand normally. Breathe in through your nose and let it out. Now, repeat after me. Oh.
Horace almost laughed, but the nobleman's face was serious.
All right.
Now this time, make the sound while folding your hands together with the four fingers extended and pressed together.
So why am I doing this?
The sound is designed to focus the mind and body, and the hand positioning aligns your ka to your purpose.
Which is what?
This time when Mulcibar formed a ball of ice and launched it at him, Horace was more cognizant of the power that welled up inside him. Like a rising wave, it flowed up from his body and ran along his arms to his fingers. He could feel it, wanting to burst forth, but he remembered the hole in the garden wall and fought to pull it back. The icy sphere exploded just inches away from his face. Splinters of ice flew in every direction, striking the pavestones at his feet and the leaves of the tree behind him, but not a single shard touched him. Lord Mulcibar led him to the bench. Horace sat quietly until the tremors subsided. It felt like a flood of energy had rushed through his body and was now slowly leaving.
That was incredible. It didn't feel like what happened during the storm at all. It was more controlled.
The Zoana is a wild force, easily provoked. That was quite good, but you must learn to have precise control of the power at all times, or you will be a danger to everyone around you.
All right, let's get back to work then.
Very good, Master Horace.
When Lord Mulcibar departed 2 hours later, Horace sat in his suite alone. Chancellor Unagon stood in the hallway with a pair of manservants.
Yes?
Jomana inhabitum harani alacti secanu.
Horace was getting better at Akeshian, but the Chancellor spoke too fast for him to follow.
I'm sorry, I didn't understand any of that.
Chancellor Unagon frowned and then indicated that they wished to come inside. Horace backed up to give them room, and Unagon strode toward the bedchamber with his servants in tow. Horace hurried after them.
Hey, excuse me.
The Chancellor opened the wardrobe and picked out a long magenta tunic with a silver starburst design on the chest, a matching skirt, and a pair of black sandals.
Ungazo harani masoku.
Then he gestured to the servants and said something about helping.
Wait a minute. Help with what?
To dress you, sire. You are to meet the queen.
The servants went into motion. Soon, Horace was wearing the selected outfit, with his face and hands washed and his hair combed. Chancellor Unagon waved him toward the door. Horace obeyed.